I'll start it.
And I know the other gentleman, but not you. I learned him. Okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the future of work, which is not the present work. And since I'm the one with the first, it's my honor to introduce the others, Jeremy Carr, Ben Kalmutter, and Andrew Farrar, for those of you. I'm Andreas Weigand. That's in my fourth country, Renaissance Weekend. And I see actually a good number of white tags here as well, which is great. And even Andrew just with respect to all of you. What we thought we would do is we'll each make two or at most three crisp points. And then we want to have a conversation, we want to discuss it. These are amazing people. And I think we happen to bring you in, but I think we'll kick it off two maximum points. Is it good? Are you involved with that?
Okay.
Down with it? Okay. Jeremy.
Are you moderator?
I do one cruise this year, but I do it as we are even.
Okay.
If each way cruise 3 points.
And you're going to make some points as well.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
But I don't think that there's anything left after the field. So.
So I'm Jeremy. I've been working in technology software for about 10 years now, big data, things like that. And I just wanted to give an engineering approach to the future of work. The first point I'm making is that I think the most important thing about outsourcing, which a lot of the tech now, is to what extent a unit of work can be defined. So to the extent that a unit of work can be defined, it can be outsourced or it can be put up to one of these work clouds. You know, we've heard of TaskRabbit, we've heard of DoMyself.com, Mechanical Turk. To the extent that you can define a piece of work, it can be outsourced. If I have a consumer product that I want to create, I can just do a CAD drawing on my computer, email it to China, and 1,000 units will show up in my door in a month. Like, that happens in today's world. So to the extent you can clearly define something, it can be outsourced, and you know, potentially, if you're an individual actor in this environment, it might not be the most valuable place for you to potentially apply your time. So then the second question is, where is value created? And I think that's around problem solving and creativity. So it's these things where there's a lot of friction between the problem definition. And we hear about this in China, where they're looking for a lot of designers, they can come up with what new products need to be created. But it's really this question around, like, what's the problem? And that's really because what you see, and so the last thing that I'd say. The unit of work definition is the most important with regards for whether it can be outsourced or not.
The more clearly defined the unit of work, the more easily the job is.
Right. And as a technologist, the derivative case of this is automation with robotics. To the extent that you can fully define something, I can build a robot that will just pump out thousands of units a day. The second piece is where is the value created then, and it's more around the problem definition and things for which there's friction between defining that process or the people that are working on that process. The last piece I'd say is that, okay, well, us as individual actors knowing these things, what can we do to best prepare ourselves, to future-proof ourselves for the future of work? And that I think is really around skills. And that's kind of the idea that the map is not the terrain. I can't know a problem from looking at a map of things about it. I actually have to dig deep into the substance of the problem itself to be able to see insights and opportunities into whether that's going to be possible or not. So we see this everywhere. If you want to be inventing genetics and biology and these, you have to be well-versed in biology, you have to be well-versed in chemistry, organic chemistry. There's a host of things you need to know. If you want to do robotics, you have to know electrical engineering, you have to know computer science, you have to know physics. You have to know the fundamentals of your field to be able to talk, not only talk credibly about it, but to spot opportunity and do that second thing, value creation of figuring out what could actually be valuable to create data. So those would be my three initial thoughts on the future of work. It has to be defined, value creation is for things that are hard to define. To be able to actually understand and begin to think about that, you have to be well versed in your field.
Thank you, Jeremy.
I'll piggyback quickly on one point you made and then present two additional points.
Great.
But it's on the outsourcing thing. This is a really interesting topic in terms of future work, which jobs will be outsourced or automated, which won't be. And I think a mistake people often make when thinking about that question is they think about high skill and low skill. And so the white collar workers will have jobs and the low skill jobs are going to China. When in fact, maybe a more helpful way of thinking about it is break it into three categories. There's low skill, there's middle skill, and high skill. So say a low skill job may be a janitor or a dishwasher. A high skill might be a lawyer at only $500 an hour, like high-end legal insight. And a medium skill job may be a nurse's assistant or a paralegal or something like that. And what we're seeing in terms of American jobs is that the high skill jobs are very secure. You're not outsourcing those anytime soon. And the low skill jobs are also secure, because it's actually very hard to automate or outsource dishwashing and janitorial work. It's the medium skill, those middle skill jobs that are being outsourced, because those are the ones that are more easily automated or offshore, and probably offshore is a better word than outsourced. And so in terms of risk in the labor market, you see folks that, it's kind of a high school diploma plus an associate's degree from community college with some skills but not a lot. Those are actually the most threatened jobs in the current economy in America. So that's one additional thought on the outsourcing thing. I think we too often make it a binary question as opposed to some nuance around the level of skill. I guess an additional point out for our discussion today is when I think about the future of work, one angle that I'm interested in is the evolving pact that exists between employers and employees. And so there has for a long time been a loyalty pact by which the employee pledges loyalty to the employer, i.e. I will work for many, many years of my life. In return, the company will offer kind of quasi-guaranteed lifetime employment. This is the HP way when HP was founded, or IBM actually explicitly laid out this idea that, hey, you have a job for life, you're an IBMer for life. And that pact has been undone in recent years. And employees are feeling much more empowered to try many jobs in their life and leave after 1 or 2 years. I think millennials on average are spending 18 months at a job. And at the same time, companies are feeling reticent to train people and offer a lot of benefits they did because their people are leaving. And so we have, I think, an evolving path in which employees are seeing more of kind of these autonomous entrepreneurial agents leasing their talent to companies for periods of time and then moving on to their next gig, and that their loyalty is flowing less vertically and to companies and more horizontally to their networks. And so they're much more loyal to a group of people in their network as they kind of traverse the career landscape. And so the thing I'm interested in, maybe we can talk about, is if you're a manager at a company today, what do you do to build a compact with your employees? What should you offer them? Should you be training them? What is the tour of duty that you're expecting from them? Because it's a much murkier situation than it's been historically, which is a nice, clean, trust compact.
I'm Judah. I'm a writer, and I'm an outlier on this panel. So I wanted to go first, because I kind of know what this is about.
trying to think about Renaissance.
Well, the future of work.
I got that part. I enjoy it. When I end up somewhere, I'm like, what are we talking about? Okay, here we go. For me, when I think about things like the future of work, and a lot of work is millennial, the question of meaning comes up a lot, which is something that really, like, the whole old school view of it with IBM, you have your job, and you're giving, you're doing your role in the larger context of the nation, the country, whatever the ills are, the fights that we're in the middle of, and that in today's day and age where the threats are murky, where it's complex, you have a lot of people who are wanting to know how their job is going to fulfill them in a spiritual way, how their soul is going to somehow be expressed in what they are doing. And we see that, especially in California, it's expressed through this sort of bucolic pastoral myth of the organic farmer. you can see it on the faces of people that walk through the farmer's market, and then look at the people who are working there, who are just totally projecting their idol onto them, and just be like, oh, you grow these apples, that must be amazing, right? And you know, the farmer's market people are like, I've been up since 3 in the morning, what do you want? Right? It's like, because of course farming is hard, which is why we industrialized it in the first place. And yet now we're going back, like, yes, it's really the meaning and the connection with the land, because we're sort of, we're moving into a post-urban experience, right? It's the second world that urbanizes massively, and we're sort of saying, well, can't we figure out a way that we can work remotely, and therefore we can be back in the land and everything, but if we work remotely, then we're missing our colleagues, and if we don't have a connection with people, then where is our meaning? And I mean with people and meaning with the land, and there are all those paradoxes that come with that, and I think a lot of the millennials, the first generation, is kind of like trying, and that's why the movie, like, what if I did it this way, what if I did it that way, what if I did it this way, and the highly educated ones are in a position to actually give that a try. And so it's interesting to see what they're going to come up with. It's also interesting to see these baby boomer and Gen X managers just go crazy trying to engage them and deal with them and really see how you can actually keep them there. And I think one of the questions is, with keeping them there, can you give them purpose? Can you give them meaning?
I think there's a connection between religiosity and, like, you're not looking for meaning in the church, so you're trying to find it and work in this way.
And that we have lost this greater sense of, like, well, you're an American. That's kind of broken down a bit.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, what is my connection to something a little?
It's not a country, it's not church, it's my job.
Which is what social entrepreneurism is that, right? This idea of, like, you're going to do business, but you're going to make the world a better place, and from that you find meaning and purpose and all that. And then there's a lot of your own vanity that plays out in that, and so, which that's not new to this world, but I think that's something that's coming up too. I know it wasn't 3 points, so.
So, I'm a physicist by training. I got my PhD in physics looking at how particles interact with each other. So, I think the 20th century was a century where observing stuff about physical stuff made all the difference. From, you know, quantum mechanics less than 100 years old to Hiroshima. This century is a century where observing interactions between people is becoming feasible. Basically, we instrumented people through mobile phones, through Facebook, you name it. So what I'm interested in is, how do we write down the equations of work? What are the many terms in the equations of work? And I personally think that an organization needs to do it from the perspective of the people who are doing the work at the company. So, for instance, the cost of describing a piece of work which needs to be done. Jeremy's point, the decomposition of work. That cost, if that cost is larger than actually doing it, it just makes no sense to offshore up that piece of work. But do we actually capture that cost right? The agony of having put the work in, then a piece of crap comes back. You know, that might just ruin my day. So how do we capture that? Meaning, my brother used to say, if it's fun, it can't be work. I mean, I think what I do is a lot of fun, and people pay me for that. So I think that notion of if it's fun, it can't be work is still gone. But how do we actually put meaning, a number to meaning? The other very good point you made, which leads to my second point, the first one being really creation, the second one being actually where is employment, meaning persistent identity at a company, like having a job, where is that still necessary? What are kinds of things where we need actually employees? And what is, in my eyes, the vast majority of the world where we move to a gig economy, freelance nation, whatever you want to call it, where we take those small decomposed tasks and farm them out to the human cloud and see what is coming back. So for instance, say logo design, 99 Designs as an example. Of course, it makes a lot more sense to have 10 people each spending 5 minutes doing what they do best. We all have certain visual metaphors we use again and again, versus having a person in-house whose job is to do many things, including the design of the visual identity. So, first point is future of work means writing down the terms of the equation of work. In my perspective, it's from a people-centric perspective. The second point is understanding where jobs really are needed as opposed to where just gigs are needed. That's something which I'm very interested in. And the last point is, let's reflect on what the building blocks are that enable the future of work. I think there are three. One is identity. Who are we? The mobile number we have, maybe, the jobs we did, maybe, I mean, all of that. How do we create trust? How do we create reputation? How do we screw up reputation? How do we screw up trust? The second building block is that my belief is about matching, sort of machine learning, that based on this persistent history we have, not a piece of paper that somebody writes some random stuff on it, but knowing what you did well in the past, knowing what you enjoyed in the past, how can we match this with things other people might not even know that they want to have it done. From your friend Marin, I now have a virtual assistant, virtual, and I think the first task was tell me things I don't even know which you could happen with. And the third point is that as a machine learning person, I think we way underestimate what the sensors around us, the 20 or 50 sensors we carry with us on our mobile phones, how much they can help us with understanding the situation we are in. And you might label it the quantified self, where some person, white guy, learned Chinese in Beijing and came out basically on top of his class because he knew which time of the day he should be doing what. Versus most of us after lunch, you know, we sit there and spend an hour writing that email which never gets sent because we should rather take a nap or something. So it is equation of work. It is, the last point was the building blocks of identity, of matching, and of situation. And in between, I think we have this point of measurement, of richer capture of what people
do. Can I ask a question to follow up on one of your points?
Yes.
About the 99 design examples really interesting. And the conclusion would be the era of being a graphic designer as a full-time job is really not realistic. And because graphic design jobs tend to be self-contained, they're easily outsourceable in discrete chunks to folks that do graphic design work on the nights and weekends. Is that kind of logical?
Absolutely, yes. Two clarifications. One is that of load balancing. Okay. That poor company who has a graphic designer, the guy is either stressing out because somebody needs to ship or sitting there and, you know, watching porn or whatever. That's one point, the load balancing. The other one is, graphic design is a wonderful example where we basically do the same thing again and again. And we have certain ideas of what we come up with, our creativity, and other people have other ideas. And it's super hard to force a composer or a designer to do something which is very different. Mm-hmm. Why don't we do something very different today? You know, I really can't. But having a sample of 10 people who all get a bit of your attention gives you just simply a much bigger spectrum which resonates with some part of it, matches with what you have.
But But is the graphic designer then, is the graphic designer a full-time graphic designer doing discrete gigs for a lot of different companies? Or would you predict, in this case, graphic design is going to be a hobby, a nights and weekend hobby, but it will no longer be a fully employable job?
I think most jobs, and I'm not taking out the trash, but most of the middle and the high-end jobs are actually all weekend jobs, where we do what we do well when we do it well. And you know, such as the logo design, if you're not inspired, you can just move, you know, the colors or change the width, but you're not getting an idea. So I think it will be that people do what they do well for much less hours than they do right now, because most of the time the designer spends at his job is probably tourism based.
Yeah. You probably know all the research about the structure of workday and the mind fighting that is actually very recent and what the best way to structure the workday.
So the 9-to-5 thing came from the day and age of production lines, where people, going back to kindergarten, were actually learned to actually basically be compliant. And part of the being compliant is that you show up at night, which makes sense if you are having stuff, the guy behind you, and if the guy is not there, it will be piling up. But I think with the cost of communication having dropped dramatically, and with most of the work we do not being physical manufacturing of stuff, those constraints are all gone. What is important is the camaraderie, the sitting next to somebody, those other things, having lunch together. I think whoever can come up with ways that those basic needs of people hanging out together can be fulfilled, work venues, work centers where people are, I actually would love to know how can we invent the future of work where we don't all sit at home and, you know, do little things, but where we still have the camaraderie or the friendship which we create without the disadvantage of inefficiencies, no load balance.
I think an important point of a shared workday is the nature of communication as well. So whether it's synchronous or asynchronous communication. If your work task requires collaborating with people and like swapping back and forth, it's actually much more efficient to be working at the same time. Even at startups with this concept, there's a concept of like core hours where everyone's in the office. Probably meetings aren't scheduled then, but it's a chance where everyone can have high bandwidth communication with each other. If it's a shared, you know, workday that's just in the cloud and it's asynchronous sort of thing, then that's okay. And it will be most efficient when the means of production, the actual graphic designer, can work on their best at doing their design. And then I can specify whatever I want. And like, depending on iteration speed, it can take place over many days or not.
So I had a friend who's a successful serial entrepreneur, and she was a lawyer. She gave up her position as partner in a law firm to start doing her career with other things. And she just felt like the rewards, incentives, and all the other, there were so many working methodologies that she just didn't enjoy. Like, she would have a colleague who was incentivized to build 13 hours to do work that she felt she could do properly and well in 2 hours. So she left it. And when we met for lunch the other day, we sat down and said, where did you come from? Where you? I said, I just sat through a 2-hour meeting. A bunch of very high power executives. And the point of the meeting was essentially information sharing. But the point of the meeting really, deep down, was this guy was lonely. And he wanted to talk to us for 2 hours and feel close to us. And so I was wondering if you guys could talk it out a little bit, because that's an interesting area, you know, empathy and a feeling of camaraderie, real life community, those kinds of things. You can talk about that in the context of work kind of in the future.
I think this concept of tribe is really important. It's not necessarily about work per se, but with Facebook, we can have more acquaintance friends, and it's a lot easier to connect at these like tier levels. I can send a lot more messages out, but it's like messages and me typing, and that's the communication type versus us talking to each other, being in a room together and having a discourse. So I think technology, you know, as a technologist, it's not really helping us connect better on like deep human connection. It's things like sports teams, you know, where you're cheering for someone in a bar together, or just playing soccer with some friends, or golf, or you know, community. And I think think you guys were on the money in that a lot, you know, with more hours being worked, the people are kind of seeking for their spiritual connection out of work, that you get this sort of situation where I'm paid a lot and I have people reporting to me so they'll listen to what I have to say, versus seeking that out in your personal connection. And that's something I noticed living in San Francisco versus going home and visiting Wisconsin where I grew up. Like, the Midwest, there's a complete difference between your friends, you go out to the bar and talk on them, versus, like, San Francisco is like work friend concept where everyone could help you professionally, but we're going to hang out and drink because it's really fun. But maybe I'll ask you for a favor in the future. But I think it's
like
you laugh,
but
this is my everyday life.
Very good. Everyone could help you out with something in the area.
Yeah.
And that's very true in most cities that are ambitious. San Francisco especially has gone through that sort of shift, but it was founded on ambition, but then it kind of quieted down.
Yep.
And now we've had the second run of it, and but yeah, so that's a crew lineup you might, and then of course it's founded not on just ambition, but now it's all about networks, right? And so, oh, build that, that will build your ambition, which cuts into the concept of friendship as a deal, or to feed your soul. And then you also get into the problem of craft. You know, like we all live in a world where you can very easily ask somebody what they do and they have a hard time explaining it to you. Or you yourself have that problem. You're like, yeah, what do you do? Like, start trying to find metaphors and analogies, right, to make it understandable to somebody else. And when that's what you do, you don't have what would be considered a craft in that very old school kind of way where at the end of it you have a thing that you have done, maybe you've done it with other people. Right? And it's like a, literally the idea of a barn raising where you raise the barn together and all of you sit down and you look at the second barn and you're like, this is what we did. And so, you know, even when somebody's like, oh, look at my new app, and you can look at it, it's not quite the same experience. We're still corporal beings who are doing their very abstract work now. And I think that's getting at some of the problems that the commission.
Yeah, I think we're actually are circling a theme here that's common interest, which is the future of work seems more fractured. People are going to be doing lots of different gigs. And how does that bear on your identity? Yourself. And actually, I would note tonight, I think last night someone mentioned never ask someone what you do, or it's kind of seen as a dirty opening question, what do you do? I actually have never really agreed with that. I've always found, hey, most people spend most of their time working. And so it is pretty interesting. It's an informative question, an interesting question to learn about someone's work. But what's happening is when the answer is not as tidy as I'm a doctor or I'm a business person, instead the answer is fractured and diverse and hard to sum up, it does kind of affect that person's identity and how people perceive them, and it kind of complicates them. But again, in my mind, it actually continues to make it an interesting question, and actually a perfectly fine question in an environment like this to get to know someone.
I like to piece those two together.
The
soul fracture nature of the multiple things that do all these things, or I've had a slash career, or a flex generation where I've changed things over time, versus finding and honing a skill to develop a craft. Is that, you know, I'm definitely one who's drawn to the notion of multiple options and doing multiple things over the course of my life, but I also think that there's something valid in the depth of time and effort and energy that it takes to understand the industry, understand the skill set, build a network, and so on those lines. I think there's sort of a bit of a tension there.
But I want to have you guys following up on that.
There was actually, you want to go, there was one other arm up there.
Okay. I really have a question on a theme that several people have brought up, which is in the context of fracturing work or gig work mentality. It seems that in the sake of efficiency, you're actually losing the opportunity for gaining. In that, one of the biggest problems that we see across certainly areas of science, literature, etc., is that the people that can take one area and bridge concepts in one area to an entirely different area. And it's across those boundaries that we need to sense why. The more you compartmentalize any individual aspect of work, the less functional you actually become, because you can only do that widget well, but not the meta activity that may be the true answer to the problem. So when you're talking about the future of work, you describe how you see the future of genius as it relates to work, or is it going to be more and more widgets?
Well, actually, to add an extension to that question, is
question the premise of the fragmentation of work. We've all talked about, like, okay, design can be chunked up. That's true. But to what extent will the economy be full of these types of jobs? Will it be 90%? Will it be 10%? It's obviously some, right? But if I look at macroeconomic trends, we went from agricultural to industrial revolution to now to the knowledge economy. And if you look at as percent of composition of GDP, certainly manufacturing has decreased as a percent, but services have increased as a percent. And this is things that are, and to me, a service economy, you know, where there's consulting, lawyers, things like that, it's like high bandwidth like interaction. So I just want to question to what extent everything ends up fragmented. And
well, high bandwidth,
because I think there's value for genius, like genius actually has a lot of value in cohesive work structures.
I don't think high bandwidth interaction, I think it's a great question. I don't think high bandwidth interaction is exclusively fragmentation. If anything, I see increasing services economy, more event planners, more consultants. Those are exactly the types of jobs that lend themselves to more individual autonomy, more ability to do many things at once, to kind of show up for 2 hours to the office, have the interaction, and do the rest of the work at home. And it's the jobs that aren't in America as much anymore that demanded more of the full work. That's just an intuition that we can.
I also have a follow-up from that. You're talking about the sort of sector distribution of how we spend our time. You simple up 150 years old or more, getting really good at making stuff. Like, we are so good at making stuff now. And moving around the world and distributing it at these awesome factories, and then just sort of small part of the population that still, you know, that runs the part of the stuff, and now we have to be services sector, which has all these things. And various parts of that have been sort of pointed out as existence as well. Even legal discovery teams almost end up in my industry. And so part of my question is sort of where is that going, and how we should, you know, what are we shouldn't spend our time on, and what is the desire behind this? I mean, it's very clear that people want cheap food and shelter and things like that. But that's very clear. So we made stuff. And now, you know, what are we trying to achieve for ourselves? What is the very time?
I mean, I guess my thought on that is, you know, we've all seen Star Trek, or maybe even WALL-E, and as we get excessively good, let's say we can create Disney-worth products, then we kind of enter an entertainment economy, where it's like, how can we spend our time to be most and dope, and then production sort of shifts in that direction. So entertainment is kind of the hedonistic end of it, perhaps, and then there's the spiritual side, and like be more substantive and investing in the relationships. But I would imagine meaning goes in that direction as we move up Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and we're up, you know, we're looking for self-actualization. It's more to be found in our community connections than just covering food, clothing, shelter.
Maybe a couple of thought experiments. One, imagine you had enough money to not worry about anything. Would you still work? What would work be for you then?
I was in Silicon Valley, I think I was supposed to start a school in Africa or something.
But be, I mean, make it, you know, I actually, that, give people a moment and actually sort of taking out the fact that, you know, you're from class. Assume you had all the data in the world. What would you now do as opposed to being hung up? How do I get the data? Assume you had it. Assume you had enough money. What actually would you do? And the second one is, I invite people, when the next time somebody asks you here, so what do you do? Don't fall into a usual, oh, I'm a product manager, XYZ, and I'm responsible for ABC. But actually, think about that situation and create something in that moment. I think it's a lot of fun. I was fall back telling people I'm a pimp and a prostitute, and they say, what? And they all aren't yours. But, so that's then the two thought experiments. One, actually, if you had all the money you need, what would you do? Really, what would the meaning be created from? What would you get your camaraderie from? I think I'm simply the only one who actually thinks that that's an important thing to be with other people, not for efficiency reasons, you know, but for, you know, we'll...
So how the circuit proverb goes with, no, with good company, no over the lawn. So, okay, fine. We, good to be with friends.
Well, to that guy, the earlier point about he was lonely, and they're all the office to have social connection.
We're going to have that project. It was back in, like, a creative tour. I was like, I feel I'm lonely here at the top. I'm going to share information, which I could have probably just emailed to everyone.
Yeah.
This is about, so I had someone once tell me that meetings should be about brainstorming decision making. Because we have technologies to share information, you can do your homework.
Yep.
Right? So, I mean, I think there's a powerful longing for connection with people. I experienced living in San Francisco. I see a lot of people experimenting right now, like dinner parties, you know, technology people doing dinner parties and stuff like that. So, like, people want to meet. That's why I asked that question about the role of empathy, because I think the whole command and control kind of hierarchy of work was the opposite of empathy. And maybe like full empathy, like you would have a period with their family, maybe that was a little bit too far, but it's somewhere in the middle, sort of the future of work.
Well, I tend to think that the future of work doesn't necessarily have community within it. I just think on the ground that's not reality. We search, we need community for hardwire as a community, but that we look for it in different ways, like coming through Napa, you know, for the weekend. But, you know, Daniel Pink writes about what the intrinsic drivers are, which maybe is to the core of it, which is, you know, we all want autonomy, we all want mastery, and we all want purpose. And that's you know, any kind of motivation has to start from that, because that drives, if we think about, you know, what is it that we want in Andrea's question, what is it that we want, it needs to have those, it needs to satisfy those intrinsic drivers, you know. But that community isn't one of those in work, because it's not in reality, you know, but we definitely need it to search it in different ways.
Is that really true that, I know a lot of people in the tech world here, and I certainly, like, I see the community part being a very strong part of the tech world. You go on any, like, job portion of the tech company, you'll see, like, three coworkers, you all have this ability to, like, hang out and do stuff together and eat free food together. Like, it's a really strong part of the community, and as Jeremy was saying, you then reflect in your friend groups in San Francisco, whether it's dinner parties or going out and drinking, and especially if for whether you're in your 20s and it really is like your entire social life, or if it's just after you've been in the valley long enough, like it is your friend group. It strikes me like that community is really strong and a very significant part, and it'd be interesting to hear if like in other industries that's not actually the case.
So, just to be conscious of time, we have 8 minutes left. So,
I think actually these are good ideas, but we see a thing of generational divide and how one continues to work. The problem right now is the absence of religious institutions and traditional institutions that provided meaning, not just religion. Obviously, there are a lot of people from San Francisco who have a multitude of different views and from other places. Okay, so it's not just religion. What I'm saying is, in this day and age, there's an absence of institutions that traditionally provide a structure that delivers meaning to people. Family? I mean, I don't know, I can barely count my hands. I work in San Francisco. So I know so few married people, let alone people with families, their kids. You know, their kids in tech. They're looking for a friend. They're looking for something to fill the void at 30-something. The void that is there due to the absence of family and other things that would have been traditionally placed. So therefore, there's this overburdening the work or the workplace with all of these technological needs that are essentially unmet. And so therefore, you find things such as these long meetings where somebody simply has this neurotic need that is unmet as a result of institutions that are no longer existing. And that's why we're talking about future work.
And what's interesting about that is that those institutions traditionally did provide that, but they provided it with very little freedom. Mm-hmm. And they upheld things like misogyny and racism and all of this stuff. And so we've kind of busted the doors off a lot of that by the fact that there are just as many women here as men, and everyone's working, and all of that. So there is this tremendous freedom. And yet at the same time, it's just like, okay, but then where are the rituals that kind of bring meaning into our lives. And because we work so much, we put it into the workplace. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. We just don't know how yet. And so there's a lot of like, maybe we can do this. Maybe we can do that. And because of that, there's a lot of disasters involved as well. But I think people are going to figure it out somehow.
I'm reminded of a friend earlier in Facebook, and he said to me, with coworkers like these, who needs friends? And I think that's a really,
Or with friends like these, who needs coworkers? So we have 5 minutes left, and I just want to make sure we do the right thing. Should we just listen to the questions people have, like 30 seconds each, and then make a decision as group what we do? Your hand was up first.
Yeah.
I'm sure some of you are familiar with David White's book, The Three Marriages, but he's a poet, David White. But his idea is that what we've made, basically, religion in our country today is work, and that where people are going to find the most meaning and the most transformation personally is in the domain of work, and that's fine. But that's what's taken the place. And I just would love to hear the panelist's point of view on that in terms of as we move into the next decade, if you think that's going to be true or not.
But let's get the other questions out and then decide what's up. Is that okay? You had your hand up, I apologize.
My career started back before there were fax machines. And in watching millennials work today, I end up constantly reminding them that companies come to business with companies, people do business with people. And no matter how much the technology gets applied, at the end of the day, the human on the other end of the line wants to know that there's a human talking, running that technology that they can trust. Mm-hmm. There's an emotional component that can't be, I think, can't be replaced by comment for many terabytes of data you work in.
A hand up there.
Yes, what I've noticed is the company has a great purpose. And I'm noticing the millennials and younger generation is that the old rules don't really apply anymore. So it's top down, one guy at the top that's really smart. Telling everyone to do this one's work as well as getting out of, setting direction, getting out of the way. Is what you hear your thoughts on, like a more bottom-up approach versus the top-down.
So the other side of the comment earlier, I'm coming out of New York, I have a partnership in San Francisco, but a lot of what's driving, from my perspective, some of this modularity and fragmentation, if you will, but flexibility and doing work at 2 o'clock in the morning because you want to get your kids up at about 3 o'clock. The people who are married and do have younger kids who do want a more fuller life, it's not just the future of work, it's the future of you. And you don't want to give up work. And men are, in this position as well. My husband is able to take my daughter to the Taekwondo class in the middle of the afternoon and go back online afterwards. And to be able to have that flexibility is driving a lot of jobs that I'm more professional. I do strategy, and I'm doing that on a consultative basis, not because it would make more sense to do it at a company side, but because of that flexibility.
So my comment plus question, I tell you these conversations about command and control, dancing often comes up, and then what happens is people take their the way they manage inside a current organizational structure and try to provide more autonomy, mastery, and purpose, but there's not. There hasn't been a disruption yet in the fundamental way that we organize ourselves, kind of to someone's point, or like managers and employees and subordinates and that whole structure that's been around for the last several hundred years. And there's a little bit of sign that, something's happening there. There's Valve, right? There's a little board. There's two companies, no managers, no titles, just principals. Curious if you guys are seeing a fundamental shift or believe there'll be a fundamental shift in actually how we organize ourselves.
Why maybe each? In summary, Jeremy, where what did we learn which we didn't know when we talked about an hour ago or a week ago when you came up with the idea of having the panel? What's your main insight?
I'm a technologist, and so I kind of go into like means of production and where are the pros and cons, like there's pros and cons of flatness versus wire, but they make sense for different industries. Sorry, that's the way it goes. I think it was really interesting to me that all the discussions we had around meetings, and I hadn't really thought as much about how important connectivity is, just irrespective of value production and things like that. So I think that's a really important concept to think about as we move into the 21st century and think about what work looks like, whether it's fragmented or not.
And if you continue that theme, I'll say I've been thinking for 5+ years about trying to start a secular church.
if anyone's interested in Frank. Yeah.
Judah, who brought up the meme of meaning?
The meme of meaning. I've noticed that if you want to know what thing has the most power to transform in a society, look at who's responsible for the tallest building. So pyramids, the pharaohs, you know, churches today, business, they build the largest building. And I think we have a generation that knows that that's where the power transformation lies. And so that is why people are looking to business to be the transformation of force.
So I just encourage anybody and everybody here who has some input into the equations of work I outlined before, see me at lunch now or later today, tomorrow, Sunday, Monday. Thank you all for making this success.